Today on Against the Grain, Leo Panitch, the great Marxist political economist, was one of the many losses we have suffered from the coronavirus. His frequent collaborator and lifelong friend Sam Gindin joins me to reflect on the enormous contributions that Leo Panitch made to a radical understanding of the state and capitalism on a global scale, as well as the limits of social democracy and the challenges the labor movement faces in going beyond the interests of particular groups of workers. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The death in December of political economist Leo Panitch left an enormous hole in the world of radical ideas. Panitch remade our notion of the role of the state in capitalist society, especially the role of the United States in shaping capitalism on a global level. He wrote extensively about the limitations of social democracy as a path out of capitalism. He was engaged throughout his life with the struggles of workers and the left, and deeply influenced generations of radical scholars who were his students. I'm joined by Leo's close friend and co-author Sam Gindin. Together they wrote The Making of Global Capitalism, as well as In and Out of Crisis, for which I was the editor, and therefore I should disclose my connection to PM Press, which published that latter book. Sam Gindin is a radical scholar who worked for decades for the Canadian Auto Workers Union. Sam, before we get into depth about Leo Panitch's ideas, some of which he developed in dialogue with you, how would you calculate the magnitude of the loss, especially in these times?
You know, the loss is at so many levels, because at one level, you know, he was an important intellectual who did important work on the state, on social democratic parties, and on the labor movement, all crucial political questions, obviously. He played a great role as a teacher. I think towards, as he got older, he began to appreciate how much he loved teaching, and he had an enormous impact on developing a whole new generation. And he left an enormous legacy at that level. I think one of the most important contributions he made, though, was as a public intellectual. He was a great speaker. He was very comfortable. He was very confident. And it meant that he was reaching a lot of people through his interviews and popular articles, but speaking at forums all over the place, South Africa, Brazil, Guatemala, Germany, everywhere. And so as a public intellectual, I think he really spread the message and tried to keep a kind of Marxism alive that was dynamic, that wasn't rigid, that could inspire. It wasn't that analysis was going to itself change the world. It had organizing was obviously the main question. But I think he showed a kind of Marxism that was historical. He took the historical very seriously, that was institutional. He didn't skip over institutions, even though there's this great emphasis on political economy. And he was always ready to challenge himself and change as things change. That was the point of history, not just to look back on history, but how history evolved and how theories and understandings evolved. And I think on top of that, you know, I've gotten so many emails after he died, and they so consistently wanted to talk about how generous he was to people personally. So he actually had this, you know, amazing personal impact on people who either came to the university as working class kids and suddenly felt that they actually belonged someplace and had something to say, or just the time he gave them in terms of reviewing their work. So his warmth was obviously crucial. You know, the big thing about Leo was the big person. He had this incredible presence in everything. When Leo was in a room, it wasn't that he dominated by talking louder or putting people down, but you couldn't ignore Leo. He had a presence in everything. He had a presence in social life. He had a presence when we were teenagers and he was dancing. So it was Leo's presence in every sense, I think, that was so fundamental. And of course, in these moments, the things that he was trying to study were so crucial. And his ability to communicate socialism as a possibility, it was so fundamental.
And of course, you have known him as a lifelong friend. Can you tell us about Leo Panitch's origins in Winnipeg, Canada?
Yeah, I guess like often when you're trying to get to somebody's biography, it's not completely determining, but things like time and place really matter a lot. So Leo and I became friends in the early 60s. Growing up in Winnipeg meant, on the one hand, it was the context of the 60s. And by the way, the U.S. itself was very important in terms of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement on the Canadian left. Winnipeg was unique in terms of its radicalism in the Jewish community, in the Ukrainian community. It had had a general strike in 1919, where the workers took over and actually, you know, ran public services. So it had a long tradition. I know in the early 50s, for example, in the middle of the McCarthy period, Winnipeg was electing, North End Winnipeg, that is, was electing a communist alderman regularly. And North End Winnipeg was where working-class immigrants lived. And it was in the air. It wasn't even as if, you know, you had to have a political discussion. It was just there. He went to a Jewish school for a while, and then a night school, but which was also quite radical and quite left. His father worked as a cutter and was active in the Social Democratic Party and also in the trade union movement. Given the times, we had a young professor at the University of Manitoba. We had a very small seminar, probably six of us in it. And that was very influential. That was one of those moments when having somebody who was constantly pushing you further and asking you questions about, yeah, but where's the power? Where does power come from? And that was very important. Leo, in one of our classes, I think it was a Latin class. Leo says it was an economics class. Had just read the introduction, Marx's introduction, Critique of Political Economy. And he turned to me and he said, I think I'm a Marxist. Later on in life, he decided that that introduction was kind of crude. And he was embarrassed about thinking that that's what made him into a Marxist. And then he went to London when he was around 22. And that was, again, the 60s in London. But that's when he met Ralph Miliband. And they really became comrades.
And this is the British Marxist thinker who was the co-founder of the yearly journal, The Socialist Register, which would ultimately become edited by Leo Panitch. And Miliband was known for his theorization of the role of the state in capitalist societies. How was Leo Panitch's engagement with the ideas of Ralph Miliband formative for Leo?
Yeah, no, they were absolutely formative. I mean, this was entering a new world. You know, it led him to his own studies of the state, but it also led him to debates and studies of the British Labour Party. That was very important, trying to understand whether social democracy could in any way be a vehicle for socialism, which he concluded it couldn't, and that in fact, if anything, it integrated the working class into capitalism, which was very much Ralph's position. Ralph was absolutely important, and they were lifelong friends, and eventually Leo began to co-edit the Register with Ralph. But Leo also tried to go beyond Ralph. He was very interested in the debate that Ralph had with Poulantzas, where the two disagreed, and so Leo studied that as well.
Over the nature of the state?
Over the nature of the state, how to understand the state, but of course that also leads to how to understand and think about politics. And then he he came back to Canada. I think that for everything he was getting out of England, he felt a bit of like an expatriate, that he wasn't quite there and might not be completely accepted as an activist and intellectual. And he got a job in Ottawa, where he did a very important book on the Canadian state while he was still quite young. And then he eventually got a job at York. I think he was interested in coming to Toronto. It was a bigger city. And at York, he really had a major influence. He became head of the department, had a major influence over hiring it. And York became really a center, one of the key centers of Marxist thought internationally. People were attracted to York because of people like Leo and Greg Albo and David McNally. So York became, you know, crucially important.
I'm speaking with Sam Gindin, a lifelong friend and frequent co-author of Leo Panitch, who died in December. We're discussing about the enormous contributions of Leo Panitch to the world of radical ideas and Marxist ideas. So you mentioned Leo's engagement with social democracy and then its limitations of thinking about what might be a path toward getting beyond capitalism. And I wonder if you could tell us more about his work around social democracy at a time when many on the left still pin their hopes that there could be a social democratic road to socialism and ultimately getting away from capitalism, which, you know, in many ways is a relevant issue today as some of these ideas have churned up again.
Yeah, no, it's very relevant. And I think that to some extent, Leo was also, I don't want to say changing his ideas on this, but flirting with thinking about it differently as circumstances changed. So his original work was, a critique of social democratic parties. The basic critique of social democracy is that the challenge is how do you create the social agency that can transform capitalism? And that meant how do you create a confident working class that can strategize and understand and organize, etc. And social democracy, I'm mixing in my own views here, which sometimes it's hard for me to separate myself from Leo's views, but social democracy has never really believed that workers can change the world in the modern era. You know, going way back, social democracy at one point just thought that the evolution of capitalism would create the conditions through regular reform would create the conditions for socialism. Well, that was really exposed. But, you know, in the post-war period, social democracy was still thinking in terms of gradual reform of capitalism. The idea that workers could change the world, I think they had lost. Workers could contribute money. They could knock on doors. They were an important electoral base. But if you didn't believe in that workers could change the world, you weren't going to construct a party that was focused on developing those kinds of capacities amongst workers. And what you're focusing more on was elections. And the trouble with elections isn't that they're not important, that Leo had rejected the idea that we will get to socialism through a Bolshevik revolution. But the point about elections is if you're elected without a base, there's nothing much that you can do. You're constrained by the fact that you don't have a base to either push you or to be organized and mobilized when you want to do something more radical. And what tends to happen is that, therefore, you become an agent of the state. You get integrated into this. If you don't have a clear independent vision that is radical, and you don't have a base that is pushing you and that you're trying to develop, you end up looking at the election as everything. And that ends up with you either weakening the working class because you're trying to teach them to accommodate, to quote, reality, and getting integrated into the state itself. And this has been, the great dilemma. And as capitalism, and by the way, I think, you know, the other part of it is how much unions had to be changed. Leo didn't see workers as automatically revolutionaries. They're working people. They had the potential to become something else. They weren't fixed. They weren't either revolutionaries or inherently conservative. But they had the potential to be developed, and that was related to the circumstances. There was always resistance. They formed organizations. It gave them resources. They had the power to disrupt, which was absolutely critical. But they weren't going to automatically become revolutionaries. And it was the role of the party to play a role with workers in terms of bringing out the best of them. And there was a long part of a point in the post-war period where militancy was enough. Workers could be militant. And one of the things that had to be learned was that unions themselves, in those moments in the 50s and 60s, could in fact win just by being particular organizations. Because unions aren't class organizations. They're particularist organizations. They represent specific groups of workers and they defend them. And those workers have all kinds of politics. The militancy led to reaction from the state. And that's what's been loosely called neoliberalism. And there's been this massive defeat of the working class. And to restore the working class, it's more important than ever that you have socialist parties with feet inside the labor movement, but also outside, who see their main role as building those capacities. And that is not what social democratic parties do. And in 2017, Corbyn had a radical program and was received, a lot of sympathy everywhere. And Leo, I think, was flirting with the question of whether he was wrong. But I think that, I just think that amongst his friends, including myself, we've debated where he really ended up. And my take on it was that even though he flirted with it, it was almost like he was hoping he was wrong. He wanted to believe he was wrong. But I think what he came down to was that he wasn't wrong. That in going into the Labour Party, on the one hand, if you're fighting to change the Labour Party, which would end up to be a bureaucratic mess, you weren't doing the work outside the party that needed to be done. And until you did that work outside the party, you couldn't win inside the party. So he saw that limit. And he saw the confusions that happened around Brexit, which we can return to if you like. And as he watched this, he was very impressed with, as with Sanders, the kind of, people were rushing into politics. Young people were coming into politics. There was a lot of recruitment. There was an enormous amount of energy. And there was a new discourse. So all of this was very exciting. And I think it's positive. Whatever somebody ultimately comes down on this, this was something, every leftist has to acknowledge. But it was also thin. And it's thin in the Sanders case in that as Sanders lost the primary, so much depended on people almost trying to find a shortcut to socialism by focusing on Sanders.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today we're talking about the late political economist and left thinker Leo Panitch, who died in December. And I'm speaking with his lifelong friend and his frequent co-author, Sam Gindin, himself a leftist scholar who worked for decades for the Canadian Auto Workers Union. So let me ask you, Sam, about the work that you and Leo Panitch did in trying to think about one of the most central questions for anyone who is interested in changing society, which is the question of global capitalism and the role of the United States within it, which was the subject of your collaborative masterwork, The Making of Global Capitalism. When people on the left talk about globalization, by and large, they often assume that it is part of a process, almost an inevitable process, that involved the retreat of the state or states around the world and things being left to sort of the magic of markets. But you and Leo Panitch argue something quite different. How did globalization or the global expansion of capitalism happen? And how should we understand the institutions that were central to it, including the role of states?
great question, and you framed it really well. You know, we should recognize that when Marx talked about, in the Communist Manifesto, a long time ago, about capitalism's tendency to nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, he was already pointing to something that sounded almost automatic. And one of the flaws, and, you know, a lot of people, including on Wall Street, started in the 90s quoting Marx because he seemed to really get this drive of globalization. One of the problems with Marx was that he didn't have a theory of the state to complement his economic arguments, and he didn't recognize that states can actually become barriers to globalization if they're trying to protect their own capital. And so that, you know, so Marx is partly at fault in this. What we really try to emphasize is that, and we call the book The Making of Global Capitalism because we want to emphasize it actually has to be made. If you actually looked at the first half of the 20th century, it looked like globalization is completely impossible. Two world wars and a Great Depression that interrupted international capitalism. So the question is, how was this made? And the United States was fundamental to this making. But let me maybe just start with the question of states generally and get to the United States. You made the point that people have seen globalization as something that circumvents states. And other people have thought that, well, if there's national states and international capital, it's just a contradiction. The states will at some time become nationalist and undermine globalization, that it would work both ways in terms of undermining it. And we didn't try to think of this abstractly and say, okay, well, how can this be resolved? We actually looked at what happened in history. And what happened was that states were internationalized. And what that means is they came to take responsibility for creating the conditions for global accumulation within their own territory, within their own borders, because they were trying to attract capital for jobs. And they also, as part of this, were open to making agreements internationally so that their capital could also go elsewhere. So capitalism was going to be treated inside every country just like domestic capital. And that's what the international of the state was about. Now, for that to happen, again, that didn't happen spontaneously. The American state, at a particular moment in history, played a critical role. And what had happened was that through the Depression and through the war, the American state had both developed certain capacities, but recognized this problem of capitalism being fragmented into empires. You know, going back in the 20s and earlier, the United States' main argument was they wanted the other empires to open up so they could also get access, so they shouldn't be exclusive. But what they began to see through the history of the century to that point was that it's very dangerous. Countries becoming nationalist and fighting over empires and excluding each other and fragmenting capitalism this way could lead to wars, and it was could impose severe limits on American capital. So they began to think about a different kind of global capitalism, which was to get rid of empires as they were, and it would be based on two basic principles. One was sovereignty. All states would be sovereign in a formal sense. They wouldn't be subject formally to other countries. And that things would be decided on the basis of markets, the free flow of capital and the free flow of trade. So that would get around how you debate who should get what. These were going to be the determining factors. Now, of course, this had to be implemented practically. It depended on the U.S. having the material ability to push this, which they did after the war. They were kind of the one place standing. It meant that they were really committed to restoring capitalism elsewhere, especially in Europe and Japan, which meant supporting the capitalist classes there and intervening with things like the Marshall Plan in Europe. And they began the construction, which is a very complex, difficult issue. I mean, how do you actually do this? And, you know, they made compromises. They let Europe have a certain amount of protectionism and government interference for a while. They gave Japan a lot of leeway, and then later South Korea in terms of exporting to the United States, but they could be protectionist. But they're trying to construct this other world. And at first, it was primarily based on the former imperial states. How do you integrate them into this new kind of a world was the major project. And then over time, it extended to integrating the global south as well. And what you have at this point in time, you know, it's the amazing fact that virtually nobody is trying to get out of capitalism. China isn't capitalism. You know, I remember the Time magazine having an article on Vietnam in the early 80s saying America lost the war, but capitalism won because Vietnam was trying to get into global capitalism. So that's what we wanted to study. How did this actually happen that America came to this notion of this kind of an empire? How did states get internationalized? How were the institutions established internationally to make all of this work? And how did this affect things inside the American states, which had to be studied? The special role of the State Department after the war, the special role of the Federal Reserve in the 70s, the role of the Treasury. So this is what we were trying to study. Now, one of the things we didn't spend a lot of time on was the CIA and the military, because that's covered. And it's not because they're not important, but it's because their goal is to make, they intervene, but they're intervening to prevent anybody from moving towards this kind of an empire. In other words, where there is a particularly nationalist movement. So their goal is to use the military or the CIA, those parts of the state, to maintain or construct a world that is in this particular image of sovereign states who accept the authority of markets. And so what we really wanted to emphasize was the role of American state institutions in doing this.
Let's take a listen now to Leo Panitch talking about the role of the U.S. state in the globalization of capitalism from a KPFA event in Berkeley in 2012.
There's a tendency in the nature of capitalism, and you can just read the first couple of pages of the Communist Manifesto and see it very succinctly described. There's a tendency in capitalism to expand by virtue of its competitiveness, to go beyond national borders, etc. But at the same time, we haven't seen until the end of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st, really the whole world becoming capitalist. And this isn't just a matter of those portions of the world, China, the Soviet Union, that were for a period closed off to capital accumulation in the 20th century. But we've seen so much of the global south, for which it was often thought on the left, you could not see the development of capitalism there. You could only see the development of underdevelopment. We've seen large parts of the global south embarking on a rapid capitalist development. Even in the countries of the north, the advanced capitalist countries, increasingly our social relations, the way we define ourselves, has increasingly been commodified. And especially in the last 30 years, the explanation about that has largely been that markets have escaped states, that markets have bypassed states, that there was a period in which states regulated and contained capital, at least in the post-war period, and then they lost that capacity. And our book is arguing instead that states have been the authors of globalization, not its victims. When free trade treaties are signed, they're not signed by multinational corporations, they're signed by governments. And if you look back at the 20th century, it would have seemed to someone standing at the beginning of World War II, that far from globalization being inevitable, far from the predictions of the first pages of the manifesto easily being realized in terms of the bourgeoisie making the world in its own image, it would have seen that globalization couldn't overcome the barriers it was running into. Two world wars, inter-imperial rivalry, the Great Depression. And yet, from the Second World War on, and especially in the last 30 years, we have seen the spread of global capitalism. We see that not as an inevitable process, but as a process in which states, led by the American state, have very actively worked to remove the barriers to the spread of global capitalism.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're remembering the Marxist political economist Leo Panitch with his close collaborator Sam Gindin. So Sam, one of the things that's also a commonplace on the left is the assumption that the U.S. is a power in decline. And you and Leo Panitch in The Making of Global Capitalism and other works challenge that notion, which has been common on the left, at least I believe, since the 1970s.
Yeah. Okay. And again, this was a very crucial part of our argument. The question is, does the U.S. really have the material basis for this? And of course, there's an empirical question here. You know, it's not like we're saying there's something in American genes that makes this inevitable forever. It's a question to study. And there was always arguments about U.S. decline, whether it was relative to Japan or relative to Europe or relative to Germany in particular or relative to China. So our argument is, and a lot of things that people look at are things like, well, a lot of American manufacturing is gone. U.S. has had perpetual trade deficits since the end of the 70s. The U.S. is capital is flowing in. This wasn't how we thought of major powers. The idea was that capital should be flowing out and getting the returns by penetrating other countries. So our argument is, first of all, that the U.S. actually empirically has had and still has the material base for empire. It is important to have a material base, and they have it. You need a material base in terms of your military, but you have to have that power if people are going to have confidence in the dollar. And the reason that the U.S. maintains this material base, even though it's lost a lot of manufacturing, is a few things. One is that it lost a lot of manufacturing, but it also had the capacity to move into the high-tech sectors, which it still is a leading factor. So it's the strategic aspects of manufacturing and corporations that they still have, with, you know, the high-tech stuff on Silicon Valley, pharmaceuticals, still in aerospace, machinery, et cetera. So you can document this. In the healthcare sector, they're unbelievably dominant. So there's that part of it. Then there's especially the fact that as a global power, it's the business services that U.S. dominated, accounting, legal, finance above all, but also engineering, software, etc. So there, too, the U.S. had the material base. The fact that they were running deficits had to do with actually their strength, not their weakness. By running deficits, they're basically able to get the labor power from places all over the world and get those goods for American consumers and American businesses because they can pay in the dollar. The dollar is fundamental to the U.S. maintaining this power because of its international role. And by the way, part of the material base and part of the strength of the dollar is that the U.S. always was comfortable in controlling American labor, that American labor wasn't a threat. When it became a threat in the 60s, threatening inflation and people starting to worry about the dollar, they crushed it. And once they crushed it, that's basically the world we've lived in since then. So there's a confidence that property rights would always be protected in the United States, so you can invest in the States with a dollar. The other thing is the same arguments with the capital flows. The fact that the U.S. gets these capital flows, well, it means that it's got access to the world savings, This isn't a problem, it's a strength. Where else is China going to put its currencies except in the United States? And if they actually decided to put them into the euro would probably be worried about their currency rising and put that in the States too. So these are strengths. The final thing I'd say about it is you can't get too economistic about this. Our argument wasn't just that they were dominant. It was that it's also a question of the role of the state, that the American state could play a particular role diplomatically, militarily, and especially through its state institutions, the Treasury, the Fed, that was critical. And you see this. When the financial crisis hit, it actually hit in the United States first. So you would say that, wow, this is showing a weakness. But what you ended up seeing through that financial crisis is that the state could develop capacities, partly because it's got the freedom to do anything it wanted. The working class wasn't a barrier saying, no, you got to save us first. They could intervene in financial markets. They sent a lot of the printing of money was to save banks in Europe. So they were playing this role of the world central bank. It was documenting the fact that this is the role of the U.S. All of capital, whatever tensions there are, all of capital wants the U.S. to survive because nobody else can play this role. The Chinese tensions with the U.S. are partly about geopolitics and the new technologies, but the Chinese they're basically bargaining over their status within the American empire. They want to be recognized as having a new status because of their growth and their importance to the world economy. They want the U.S. to act as a responsible imperial power and not act arbitrarily the way that Trump seemed to do. So it's, you know, things can change. There can be all kinds of conflicts that emerge that the U.S. may not have the capacity to deal with. China's growth down the road, this may lead to changes. But right now, China doesn't want the responsibility of playing the American role. It would mean liberalizing their own financial system. And they don't want to do that because their financial system is how they control their economy and legitimate themselves, since they're not legitimating themselves through democracy. So China doesn't want to play the American role. They don't want the burdens that involves. And by the way, this does involve some burdens, which is what Trump was saying when he said, make America great again. He was saying, why is it that if we're this power, we also have the burdens of losing jobs in the Midwest, et cetera. So there are burdens to empire, but ultimately it strengthens American capital and American capital accumulation. So I guess what we really have to appreciate is that this is a new kind of empire. It isn't just that America is number one when Britain was number one before. It's an empire that actually integrates all of capital, so limits the potential conflict between them. Not that there isn't tensions, but the fear that if the U.S. when the U.S. was going into Iraq, that Germany, Leo and I were in Germany at the time, interviewing Chrysler executives and also Daimler and German companies, and what the German manufacturers were saying, they were afraid that their government might take an oppositional position on Iraq, which would hurt them in business in the United States. The point was how integrated everybody was. And that kind of gives a lie to the notion of expecting inter-imperial conflict, which, given this kind of integration, is very unlikely in terms of people challenging each other for who's going to dominate, which, again, doesn't mean there aren't going to be conflicts.
So what are the stakes in terms of getting this question right about the role of the United States in the management of global capitalism?
One obvious thing is that people who think that the U.S. is going to decline and therefore globalization is going to fall apart and capitalism is going to somehow fade away are premising all their politics on just waiting. You don't have to actually think about how are you going to actually transform this? So, I mean, it's problematic that way. The second thing is, though, even though we're talking about globalization, the real site of struggle is in each country. And that might sound paradoxical, but the point is, you know, the concept of the internationalization of the state emphasized that states, our own states, are responsible for the making of global capitalism. And it's these states that you have to transform. You know, you can't through militancy just announce, for example, that we're going to end free trade. Free trade isn't something that was imposed on states. Free trade was, as Leo used to say, states were the authors of free trade. The Canadian state was begging for free trade with the United States so they could have access to American markets. So it focuses on states. Now, you do this with an international sensibility, of course, but if you really want to help other countries internationally, for one thing, if you're giving up things and making concessions at home, you're undermining workers elsewhere. Anytime you're actually fighting domestically, you're creating space for other people to struggle. And to really help, you know, foreign countries, you have to be in power of your own state so you can do things like, say, we're going to cancel your debt. Or we know that you need this technology. Why don't we share it with you? We've already got it. In the same way that you share a computer program. Why not? So to really help other countries, it is a question of developing the power in your own country to do that. And notions of international solidarity on specific things are always possible, you know, like intervention with American troops. But the notion of having unions negotiate things internationally, because now we're dealing with international companies, the problem with it is that what it tends to do is replicate American business unionism internationally. It forgets about the question of the state and building alliances within your own country. And it's just not practical. If you can't build solidarity and unity in your own country between public and private sector workers or auto workers and steel workers who are competing to organize something, you're not going to be able to build it internationally. So you know, there is this, you know, I think Marx had the line of you have to come to terms with your own bourgeoisie first, because in form, this is where struggles take place. In substance, he also added, though, struggles are international, because every time you're fighting in one place and creating more space in one place, space for struggle in one place, it affects everybody.
Well, Sam, let me end by looping back to something earlier from our conversation and ask you about how you and Leo Panitch understood what people on the left or radicals or people in the workers' movement are up against with a working class that has become further integrated into capitalism. Can you tell us how you argued that that process happened, this integration of the working class, and how that can be frontally challenged?
This is the question. First of all, we shouldn't romanticize the working class historically. I mean, the point about workers under capitalism is they're dependent on their boss. They can hate their boss, but they're still dependent on him for their job. They're fragmented in different workplaces with such different conditions, as you can see, you know, comparing Amazon and public sector workers. So they're fragmented in all kinds of conditions. Some people have two jobs, part-time jobs. So that's a problem. You have them thinking in the short term because they're trying to survive. Increasingly now you have them exhausted because you know, it's taking two earners to make an income. So there's all these things going on. And then there's the specific defeats of the working class that have occurred. The great defeat of the last few decades isn't just that workers lost some wages or a benefit. There's been a lowering of expectations. And this is all related to the defeat of the left. We can't just talk about it in terms of unions. It's because of the defeat of the left, a left that isn't integrated or penetrating or engaged with workers, that socialism begins to disappear. So everything is about accommodation. So the question of where do, you know, it doesn't mean that there aren't contradictions in capitalism. I mean, one of the contradictions we have to really keep remembering is that as capitalism restructures to increase its power, like through value chains, it's also becoming more vulnerable. Capital can be, you know, disrupted enormously if you happen to be making a part. We're seeing this through the pandemic, but no one's talking about it in terms of, well, what if workers were the reason for it rather than the pandemic? If they could cut off supply someplace, then, you know, there's all kinds of parts of the economy that even though they're part of international capitalism, like Amazon or Walmart, you shut down those warehouses there, they can't just move to another country. We have that power. You know, education and healthcare sectors, which are so important, they're rooted. So we shouldn't feel like we're so helpless, is one thing. The other thing is that I think we've passed the point of militancy alone. Militancy is always important because it forces questions. Resistance is fundamental. You don't give up. You know, if you're not fighting in your own workplace, you're unlikely to fight for bigger things. But we have to start thinking in terms of class. If you're not thinking in terms of class, we can't cope with the scale of the problem we're dealing with. And just as an example, with on this question of unionization that we mentioned earlier, in the 30s, the miners had this notion of they were organized, but steel wasn't, and this risked them being isolated. So they put 100 workers out in the field to organize steel. And this is what you need. If you really want to organize, you have to think of it as a crusade. You have to think in terms of it's building the class, not just it's giving you new members. You have to think in terms of educating your own members so they become organizers. But when you think of it in business terms, and narrow terms about your own union, you can't win. So fighting to get the notion of class into unions isn't just an ideological thing. It's a practical thing. That's how you can win strikes. You can't win strikes in the public sector if you're not organizing other workers in the community about the service. Otherwise, they just think of it as, yeah, you want better benefits, and it's going to be our taxes. So class is fundamental. That's one thing. The other thing is we have to cope with this problem of competitiveness. It is such a disciplinary fear on workers, including in the public sector, because there's always the argument that if we don't attract capital, you won't have a tax base for the services. It's such a disciplinary, you know, thing, and we have to think about how do we deal with this. And that raises big questions about free trade and the flow of capital. But I think in the interim, we can try to think about carving out spaces that aren't based on the market. And the obvious one is the environment. If we actually start saying, look, the environment can't be fixed by fragmented private corporations competing for profit. We need some planning. You can't plan unless you control what you're planning. We actually have to have a part of the economy that is thinking about what do we need to make and change since the environment is going to need us to fix everything about how we live, work, travel, etc. And start thinking about, you know, a section of the economy that's that's focused on that. And that means conversions. It means if a plant is going to close because it's not profitable, you make the argument, well, it certainly can be used for something else. That's one thing we have to do. Another space is we've got a lot of public services that aren't directly in the market, but they're run in commercial terms. Why aren't we fighting to democratize them? In terms of the role of workers, but also in terms of their relationship to the people that they service. A third thing is we have to deal with finance. As long as finance can move wherever it wants, again, there's this discipline, and we'll probably find it down the road when they start arguing about deficits again. And we're not powerful enough to say, well, let's nationalize finance. We can say it, so it's at least thought about, but we can't do it yet. But why not carve out some spaces like an infrastructure bank or a green bank? But what you can't do is just say we created a green bank and now it's going to get into the market and compete for funds that will be used for the environment. You have to say we are giving it funds so it can fulfill the mandate of acting in the social interest. And the way we're going to get those funds is by levies on all financial institutions. We're going to tax them. We're going to take back some of the uncountable funds we've given them and create these things. So that's a certain kind of strategy. Now, I think the advantage of all of this is that if you really had national campaigns to do this, you wouldn't just debate whether to stay in the Democratic Party or not, or whether to, whether to try to increase your own small group. You could have national campaigns that are on the agenda, including things like healthcare, obviously. And having those national campaigns would do a number of things. One is it would sustain everything that's been built, which is in danger of fading away, the infrastructure of it, the communications, the links between people. It would also expose contradictions in the Democratic Party. You couldn't just go into the you'd have to say, this is what you stand for, and it would expose the fact that the Democratic Party doesn't. I think it would be a protection against the risk of social democratization of a lot of the left, of going into the Democratic Party and fighting for small gains, but really themselves being integrated. And it would build, hopefully, if we can do it in some kind of respectful way, which is a real capacity that's missing on the left, argue all the time, deeply argue, but not see other people as the enemy. And, it could be part of joint struggles in these campaigns that eventually move people and, begin to make it possible that you can have a socialist party. Because the real strategic question is, we need an institution that can perform the role of a party. That's a space where we can strategize, where we have a collective memory, where we can make links, we can choose tactics, we can practice democracy, all those things. They just can't happen spontaneously or through single-issue movements. And the big stumbling block is, well, how do we get there? And that leads to having to think about the potential role of workers in this. Big question.
Indeed. Sam McGinnon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you, Sasha.
Sam McGinnon is a left scholar who worked for decades in the Canadian Auto Workers Union and was the lifelong friend and frequent collaborator of Leo Panitch, whose ideas we're remembering today. Together, they wrote The Magisterial, The Making of Global Capitalism, which was published by Verso, as well as co-authoring with Greg Albo, In and Out of Crisis, which I should disclose that I was the editor for and have a connection with the publisher. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.